You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 35th week of the year from August 26th to September 1st, covering Numbers 4:17 through Numbers 6:3. So, in this part of the Bible, God is explaining to Moses and Aaron a number of sort of technical details of how the tabernacle is to be managed. But there are, as always, there are interesting insights we can gather from these ideas for recovery. So Numbers 4:17 says, God spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Do not let the tribe of the Kohathite families be cut off from among the Levites. Thus shall you do for them, so that they shall live and not die. When they approach the Holy of Holies, Aaron and his sons shall come and assign them, every man to his work and his burden." So the Kohathites were a branch of the tribe of Levi. They were Levites. Kohath was one of Levi's sons. The Kohathites were his descendants. So the family of each of Levi's sons had their own special distinct duties to perform around the tabernacle. In the case of the Kohathites, the priests were to supervise them in their work inside the tabernacle. So according to the commentators, the purpose of the supervision was to ensure that the Kohathites not compete with one another in their rush to do their holy tasks, jostling each other and pushing one another out of the way to get to their holy tasks and thereby desecrating the tabernacle. The problem is that even when the task at hand is holy, our egos can still get in the way. We can still want to compete and be the holiest, holier than our brothers, and denigrate the spirituality of the environment in the process. This can happen in recovery as well, with AA group members acting competitively and with ego, letting the pursuit of status and position cloud the proceedings. We don't have priests to supervise us, but we do have our elders, people with serious time and wisdom, who can guide us in how we work to create the right kind of spiritual fellowship. We should listen to them. Numbers 5:5-5:7 reads, God spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel. A man or woman who commits any of man's sins by committing treachery toward God, and that person shall become guilty, they shall confess their sin that they committed. He shall make restitution for his guilt in its principal amount and add its fifth to it, and give it to the one whom he is indebted." This is God's process for a thief to make up for his crime. First, the thief must confess. Then he must make restitution to the victim, adding a penalty of one-fifth. So if you stole $100, you would pay back $100 plus a $20 one-fifth penalty. So the case described here is actually different from what you might think. It refers actually to a person who withholds wages or denies that a loan is due, in effect swearing that he does not owe the money. So I lend my friend John $20, and I come to collect, and he says, "I don't owe you the money. I swear to God that I do not owe you this money." So he's stolen from me. And what makes it worse is that he's swearing to God that the money is not owed. Thus, not only is he committing a sin towards me, he's committing a sin towards God. So he doubles his problem. And in general, the Bible makes a distinction between sins committed between two people and sins committed between a person and God. They both have to be dealt with, but they are dealt with differently. And recovery, this relates to recovery in the sense that it's necessary to be careful about money and financial relationships. And self-seeking can lead to dishonest dealing with others and getting into gray areas about debt. You know, people say, oh, I thought you were just giving me that money. That was a loan, really? You know, that kind of thing. And addictive behavior can push you right over the line, of course, into stealing as well. In all cases, though, to get sober, you have to admit what you did and make amends. And you can see the concept is discussed directly in the Bible. Numbers 5:8 reads, if the man, the victim of the theft, has no kinsman to whom the debt can be returned, the returned debt is for God, for the priest, aside from the ram of atonement with which he shall provide him atonement. So this is more detail on this process of making restitution to the victim of theft, and it describes a situation where the person who you owe this money to has died. So let's say John owes me $20 and then I die and I have no family, so there's no one to inherit from me. So what do we do with John? Do we let John off the hook? No. The way it works here is, you know, because according to the previous verse, if you steal money, you have to pay it back plus a penalty of 1/5. Then you have to make an offering of atonement. So it's actually a four-step process. You confess, you pay back the money, you pay the penalty, and you bring an offering, a ram, a male sheep. Okay, you have to do a lot of things if you steal money and swear falsely about it. So if the victim of the theft has died and has no family who will inherit him, then the repayment and penalty is still due, but it's paid to the priest along with the offering. So you're basically paying the money to the tabernacle, to God. Now this situation in recovery, this kind of situation, comes up more than you might think. You know, when we make amends, we often find that it's not possible for a variety of reasons to repay money or make a situation right with the person we wronged. The person might be dead, or we may not be able to find them, or for reasons of privacy or avoiding emotional harm to others, you simply can't make the amend directly. What should you do? Should you forget about it and move on? That is not the best course of action. One approach, there are several ways you can handle this. One approach is to make up for your behavior by donating to a charity that is related to the victim's situation. So for example, if you committed an act of violence, but the person you harmed cannot be found, you can make a donation to a charity that helps other victims of violence. So you kind of pay it forward to other similar people. Or you can make what are called living amends. You can live your life the right way and help people similar to those you wronged in the past. Now Numbers, the next couple of verses, deal with a topic that is a little bit hard to understand from the modern perspective and is potentially a little bit sensitive and controversial, but if you'll bear with me, I'm going to explain it in a way where I hope it'll make sense in the recovery perspective. It's talking about a person known as the sota in Hebrew. A sota is a married woman who is suspected of adultery because she was seen secluding herself with another man. So the Torah describes an elaborate ritual that the priest goes through with the sota to determine if she is actually guilty of adultery or if she's not guilty. And if she's guilty, she's punished. And just for clarity, it's you have to understand that anything that happens to the woman can happen to the man. So it's also, of course, strictly forbidden for a married man to seclude himself with a woman. And whatever punishment a woman might receive for this behavior will also be carried out against the man. So although the Torah talks about the woman, it does also affect the man. Numbers 5:11 to 5:13 reads, God spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, any man whose wife shall go astray and commit treachery against him, and a man could lain with her carnally, but it was hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she became secluded and defiled, but there was no witness against her, and she had not been forced. The verse describes the process which the priest performs when a married woman is accused of possible adultery because she secluded herself with another man, a charge she denies. The priest performs a ritual to determine if the woman is telling the truth. For our purposes, what caught my eye here was this phrase, hidden from the eyes of her husband. How does this relate to us? What behaviors do we hide from others? What secrets are we carrying around, allowing to poison our actions and thinking? You know, there's a great saying in recovery, which is, you're only as sick as your secrets. Though this is a bit simplistic, it's also quite true in its essence. Secrecy is the breeding ground of addictive acting out and relapses. The healthy thing to do is to bring those secrets out into the light of day. You don't have to publicize them. You can tell your sponsor. But admitting your secrets can help you reduce their power over you. So Numbers 5:14 continues, says, with this, continues with the sota. It says, and a spirit of jealousy had passed over him, meaning the husband, and he had warned his wife, and she became defiled, or a spirit of jealousy had passed over him, and she had not become defiled. The man shall bring his wife to the priest, and he shall bring her offering for her a tenth ephah of fine barley flour. So the construct here is interesting, and you see this a lot in the Bible. You have to present both possibilities. Either she became defiled or she didn't. But either way, if he's jealous and suspicious, then he's to bring the wife to the priest and bring an offering for her, an offering for the tabernacle, in this case, barley flour. The verse continues the description of the jealous husband and his wife, whom he suspects of infidelity. He brings his wife to the priest and makes an offering on the altar as part of the process of working through the situation. And it's a good example of how we can deal with toxic thoughts. Jealousy and envy are two of the worst culprits when it comes to addictive behavior. They are major drivers of anger and resentment, as well as all manner of irrational, self-destructive thinking. Feelings of jealousy are universal. None of us are immune to them. Yet, how we handle ourselves when we are in their grip makes a big difference when it comes to sobriety. Like the jealous husband, we should take our feelings to God. If we can learn to turn over our feelings of jealousy and envy, we will rid ourselves of their destructive hold on us. It's also worth noting that only a husband who is considered morally pure can even bring a sota accusation. If the husband is suspected of immorality himself, he's prohibited from the ritual. So this is another counterbalancing factor in favor of fairness. So this detail should encourage us to make sure that our own house is in order, so to speak, before we start pointing fingers at others, a common habit of people with addiction problems. Numbers 5:23 to 24 continues with this description of the sota ritual. It says, the priest shall inscribe these curses on a scroll and erase it into the bitter waters. When he shall cause the woman to drink the bitter waters that cause curse, then the waters that cause curse shall come into her for bitterness. So what this is saying, you have to kind of imagine what this is. The priest takes a piece of paper or parchment and writes on it a number of curses, curses of biblical origin. And he then takes this paper and puts it into a glass of water or a vessel of water, and the ink dissolves. So imagine like the words like bubble off the paper and the water becomes like dark with the ink. And then the woman has to drink this water. And according to the Bible, if the woman is guilty of adultery, this water will kill her. If she is not guilty, it will not kill her, and she'll be vindicated. So the bitter waters these are called the bitter waters or the soto water, or which school children sometimes call soda water as a joke. The bitter waters that contain the ink from the name of God have the potential to make the woman die if she's guilty of adultery. Otherwise, she will live. As the commentators say, it's normally forbidden to erase the name of God. So, I mean, this is a really interesting detail. What the priest writes on the paper has the name of God on it. He then dissolves the name of God in the water, which is normally strictly prohibited. You are not allowed to erase the name of God. In fact, it's an interesting little detail. If you go, most synagogues have a area where they put old prayer books and Torahs and stuff because they will never throw out or incinerate the name of God or even cross it out. So. Or tear it up or anything. So what they do is every couple of years they actually bury it in a Jewish cemetery. So it's an interesting modern example of this commandment in action. But in this case, the priest is allowed to erase the name of God if it will bring peace between a man and his wife. And there's a lesson for us here. You know, for peace between a husband and wife or any important relationship, extreme measures may be necessary. God, you can go to extremes. In this case, you could even violate what is normally a rule of the Bible. Peace in a relationship is so important that God actually commanded that one of his important rules be broken. Another way to interpret this is that God is willing to forgo some ego and vanity by allowing his name to be erased if it will help two people reconcile. And I don't mean to imply that God has ego and vanity, but normally you're not allowed to denigrate the word of God or God's name. So, but God's saying, like, don't worry, in this case it's okay. You can I don't care. You don't have to honor me at this moment. It's worth it to make peace between these two people. So if God is willing to give up some of his status for the sake of peace, maybe we should be able to do this as well, difficult as it might be. Numbers 6:1-6:3 says, God spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, a man or woman who shall disassociate himself by taking a Nazarite vow of abstinence for the sake of God, from new or aged wine he shall abstain, and he shall not drink vinegar of aged wine. Anything in which grapes have been steeped, he shall not drink, and fresh and dried grapes he shall not eat. So a Nazir, or a person who takes a Nazirite vow, it's a vow of abstinence. So for a period of time, I think 30 days, the Nazir will not drink wine or cut his hair. So, generally speaking, Judaism doesn't encourage asceticism in life, but it does give this opportunity for a person to undergo a period of abstinence. So this might sound familiar to us, because obviously abstinence from drinking is one of our main defining characteristics. But what's interesting here is how the Bible also forbids the Nazir from consuming grape products, which are not wine, but he can't drink vinegar or eat raisins or grapes. Or anything, or grape jelly, nothing from grapes. And, you know, this is very wise, because what I've seen, I've been through this myself, and I've seen so many people do this, is as addicts, we sometimes fool around with the boundaries of behavior and substances, things that we're technically free to do according to the program, which are risky. So, you know, if you're a sex addict, you know, you go to the beach and look at people in bathing suits. If you're a gambling addict, you play games that are where you bet games for you know, plastic chips instead of money. You're doing something that's technically legal but not a good idea. You're flirting with your addiction. So it's a warning against boundary behaviors. Also, what's interesting, you always have to look at where verses are placed in the Bible. They can help you understand what they mean better. The placement of the Nazirite verse, which comes right after the discussion of the Sota, the woman suspected of adultery. The commentators say that a man might want to take a vow of Naziris, a Nazirite vow, after witnessing this episode of the Sota. And watching, and the idea is that watching scandalous, shocking behavior can be triggering. And this is so true in the current era. You know, we have all kinds of information and media flowing in our direction, and it can trigger us into addiction or trigger us into these sort of boundary behaviors or disrupt our serenity. And we may, for our sobriety, need to avoid disturbing news or information. It just might be healthier to stay away. You know, I was once told my sponsor, you know, I listen to this radio show, and it's the guy tells all these weird jokes, and it's kind of makes me edgy. And he said, so don't listen to it. Like, well, that was easy, right? Just don't listen to it. You don't need that.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com